You're invited to the ultimate celebration this New Year's Eve across the ABC. Join Zan Rowe and Charlie Pickering, bringing you live music from the Sydney Harbour Stage, including Melanie C, Matt Corby, The Cat Empire, Peach PRC, Marsha Hines, Casey Donovan, Don West, Jem Casadaley, Aisha Madden, and more.
Absolutely huge.
And two spectacular fireworks displays to light up the night sky. Audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
Celebrate New Year and welcome in 2026 on ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
Wurundjeri Country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and on today's Boxing Day edition of The Breakfast Wrap, an all-women crew prepares to set sail in the Sydney to Hobart yacht race. You'll hear from the skipper.
I am on the boat, just checking our final spares that we're taking and that everything's tied down and ready, because it's going to be pretty bumpy for the next 2 days.
Then, 4 years after a military coup, Myanmar holds elections. But will anything change? We have expert analysis.
It's not a foregone conclusion that this will turn into nirvana, that's for sure.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. In just a few hours, the world-famous Sydney to Hobart yacht race will begin. And already there are a few milestones to celebrate. It's 80 years since the race began as a casual cruise between 9 yachts. It's also 50 years since the first all-women crew crossed the finish line on the Barbarian. Safe to say, the sport has since evolved. This year, women sailors make up 12% of the Hobart fleet. Ahead of the race, host Barbara Miller spoke with Elizabeth Tucker. She's the owner and skipper of First Light, the first all-women crewed yacht to compete in the past 7 years.
Thanks for taking time so close to the race. Just give us a sense of what final preparations look like.
Well, right now I am on the boat, just checking our final spares that we're taking and that everything's tied down and ready, because it's going to be pretty bumpy for the next 2 days.
Yeah, the forecast not sounding great. How much of a worry is that for you?
It's not really a worry. The boat's built for tough conditions, so that's not really a concern. But it's just a bit unpleasant. I mean, it's a bit chilly and we just got to get through it.
Now tell me about the boat and how you got this all-women crew together.
Yeah, so this is actually quite a historic boat. It holds the record for the quickest circumnavigation of the world of a 40-foot yacht, and was sailed by Cole Brower, who became the first American woman to sail non-stop solo around the world in 2023. And I bought the boat in Spain, sailed it back with Cole to Australia, and then advertised an all-female crew on Instagram and had over 100 applicants. And now we're racing. It's race day.
And there are how many of you now?
So there's 6 sailors on board, and we also have an onboard reporter to capture everything as we go.
So how did you whittle it down from the 100 who expressed interest?
So that was quite a long process. So I went through all of the applications and made sure that sort of picked those who had the right experience and the right attitude, those who wanted to learn the most. And then got down to 20, and then we had trials on the boat. Took 10 into a program, and then we've been training since May with those 10. And I'm really pleased to say that a number of those who aren't sailing with me today are sailing in the race on other boats, which is fantastic. But to me, the 100 applicants really show just how many females there are out there wanting to get rides to Hobart who are more than capable of going. So hopefully there'll be more and more participation each year.
Why are you so passionate about getting more women in sailing?
Well, I think we're definitely underrepresented in the sport, but it's been incredible for me. I've learned so much resilience and lots of life skills from it. But also I love it, and I see those same benefits that all the other women I sail with have. But more than anything, I see how much those women want to sail and how much they've put into it. But just the opportunities out there are so much less for us.
And because just a few years ago you were in the corporate world, what prompted this complete change in your life?
I think I just like challenge. I came into sailing late. I only started sailing in 2020. And I do like to master things. So I sort of throw myself fully in. And work was kind of getting in the way. So I was hoping to go over to do the Fastnet in July 2023. And I couldn't because of work. And I decided, well, one needs to go and it's not going to be sailing.
Elizabeth, tragically, of course, two sailors died during the race last year. What extra precautions have been put in place?
So the race committee have did a full assessment of those situations and did a downwind heavy air seminar, so a training session open to all sailors. And they also added extra safety equipment to ensure the quick retrieval of man overboard. So the CY take it really seriously and make sure we're all safe, as safe as we can be. And they also upped the crew requirements and the safety requirements, like qualifications for sailors. So I feel quite confident that all of the crews, not just us, are prepared for the conditions. And hopefully we won't see any of those same tragedies again.
Yeah, hopefully. Now, what can you tell us? What can you disclose about your race strategy? Anything you can tell us?
We just want to get there. we want to get there. We want to get there happy and have fun on the way. We will try and be competitive. But it's really about preserving ourselves and preserving the boat. The first 2 days will be pretty tough. And it's probably going to be quite difficult to get sleep and sufficient food and water. So that's probably strategy one, is just making sure we're strong enough for the whole race.
Now, if all goes well, you will be the recipient of the Barbarian Trophy that honours the first all-female crew that finished 50 years ago. What will it mean for you to receive that trophy?
I guess I probably have mixed feelings. One part is receiving a participation trophy is, you know, it has a bit of a negative connotation. But I really do think, you know, we're the first fully crewed all-female crew since 2018, and I think we're only the 14th in the history of the Hobart, and so that means a lot to me. We've put a huge amount in, and I think that given the number of, with only 12% of female sailors, I think it's important to have those trophies to recognise the achievement.
Elizabeth Tucker, the owner and skipper of First Light. In this post-Christmas period, it can be a particularly busy and dangerous time to be on the roads. And despite improvements in the past 30 years, from smarter cars to tougher road rules and penalties, the number of deaths has begun to creep up again, with last January's road toll hitting a 12-year high. For more on this, Barbara spoke with Russell White. He's the founder and chair of the Australian Road Safety Foundation.
What trends are we seeing in road fatalities in the past few years?
Well, I think sadly what we've seen is a progressive march with an upward trend, tragically, with road trauma. And I think we'd become so conditioned to seeing road toll statistics coming down year on year pretty much since 1970. But I think probably 4 or 5 years before COVID, that downward trend had levelled out. And certainly what we've seen since 2020 is a year-on-year increase back to a point where we've got the same road toll as we had pretty much in around 2006. So that's a real concern, and I think it's even more concerning when the things that we had been used to getting results with, things that had traditionally lowered our road toll fatality rates, just don't seem to be being as effective anymore. So there's a number of questions that we have to look at, not only from a policy or a governance standpoint, but what are we doing as a culture when it comes to something like the tragedy of road trauma?
It certainly seems to be pretty easy to get a fine for speeding, and there would have to be more speed cameras around now than 20 years ago. So why aren't they working and measures like cars with automatic brakes?
Well, I think the thing is that the fine or getting caught doing the wrong thing is not really dealing with the problem. That's a symptom of a broader problem. And you're right, we've got more road safety interventions in terms of cameras and other detection devices, whether that's red light, whether that's speeding, whether it's the new mobile phone detection gantries, those sorts of things. We've got more of that than we've ever had before. Sadly, it's not producing a result in terms of reduction. So again, as I said, what we're doing there is we're treating a symptom or we're finding a symptom rather than looking at the cause. And I think there's been some fundamental changes that's happened, certainly as I've travelled around Australia and I talk to people. Almost universally, everyone admits that the roads have become a much more hostile place, less forgiving, more road violence, people seeming to be more focused on their own agendas and getting to their own destination. And so I think, you know, the speed camera, the enforcement, the better road design, the better vehicles, we certainly need to keep doing that. I'm not suggesting for a second that we don't continue to do that. But I think we also have to look at, you know, what's happening in terms of how we're educating people about road use? How are we producing, I guess, a more cohesive road network with people understanding that as road users, no matter how we're using it, whether we're on a bike or we're walking or we're driving something, we're all part of that broader community. And I think we've got to somehow got to try and get a sense of community back to being part of that road safety education.
You're saying it's road users' attitude towards driving that, in your view, is the driving force, as it were, behind this reduction in progress on road deaths.
Yeah, I think when we're looking at how complex the road situation is, I mean, we've got to remember too that the roads are a melting pot for all sorts of beliefs of attitudes of, you know, actual views on life, you know, even things like youth crime, that all ends up in the road safety space pretty much as well. So I think what we've got to look at is what are we doing in an education space to get people more aware? Because I think it's not so much attitude, Barbara, to be honest, it's probably more apathy of people thinking, well, nothing bad happened yesterday or last week, or, you know, I know what I'm doing, I know the road really well. If something happens, it'll be someone else's fault. And I think we've got to somehow change that narrative that, you know, no matter what happens, even if technically you weren't in the wrong, maybe you also contributed to that situation through a practiced habit or a belief system or just something that you got away with a couple of times before. And that can come down to something like, you know, the last minute manoeuvre. You know, someone's heading off a freeway or about to head off, but they realise they're in the wrong lane, in the far right lane. They'll still make a desperate attempt to try and get across, even if that means crossing all four lanes and only just making it to the off-ramp. Rather than just going, I've made a mistake here, I'm going to have to go to the next one and deal with my personal error then. So, as I said, I think we could call it attitude, but I also think we've got to address the other A word, and that's apathy.
The New South Wales government has set a target to halve by 2030 the number of road fatalities. Is that achievable?
Look, sadly, I think no. I think if we're talking about 5 years' time, when all the graphs are showing us that everything's heading in the opposite way, I think it's fine to have a bold prediction. I think it's fine to have a bold target, but we've got to do something radically different to what we're currently doing if that's going to be achievable. And, you know, I would have said yes, it probably is achievable if the last 5 years hadn't been year-on-year increases. And I think also, you know, when we do see, just I guess through the nature of, you know, where we are as a nation, you know, cutting funding for some of those critical, you know, internal aspects of road safety from a leadership level, from a government level, from a road funding level, that's not helping either. You know, if anything, we should be well and truly increasing the amount of funding for all sorts of road safety activities, just as we do for other issues that seem to, you know, occur from time to time. There's a lot of focus that can happen, and it proves it can be done quickly when the need is great enough. And what my concern is that, yes, it's great to have you know, those sort of targets. But unless we really go, and we've also got to look at how have we been projecting, have we been tracking in recent years, and it's just it's not heading downwards, it's heading upwards, and it has been doing that consistently. So to say we're going to halve it in 5 years' time, that's a great goal, but the question becomes what things are we going to be doing? And I think we have to look at doing more in that school space. We need to be making people better road users from as early as possible, and I think that can start as far as preschool goes. And then I think looking at areas like work-related road safety, you know, the workplace laws that we have in this country that cover factories, that cover offices, that cover commercial buildings, shopping centres, those same laws apply to operating a vehicle. So I think we've got to put some more teeth around how people drive for work purposes. And I think the other final thing we've got to try and do is somehow, again, create a sense of greater community. But that's a bigger problem, that looks at, you know, the cultural side of things that are happening within our country on a broader level, not just what's happening on the road. So there's a few things that we need to do in the short term and do them fairly quickly if we're going to even have a hope of not only meeting a target like that, but even just bringing the road toll down.
Russell White, founder and chair of the Australian Road Safety Foundation. Turning overseas now. Myanmar's military government will begin a two-phase general election on Sunday, the first since it seized power in a coup 4 years ago. The military junta says the vote represents a return to democracy, but it's widely been dismissed as a sham. Murray Hebert is head of research at Bauer Group Asia in Washington. He spoke with Barbara.
Many analysts are calling this a sham election. Opposition parties are banned, critics have been jailed, and large parts of the country are unable to vote. Does the poll have any credibility?
Well, you've summarised it pretty well right there, that there's an awful lot of strikes against this election with such a small percentage of the population voting. Now, there's and a lot of the armed ethnic groups are not participating at all. I guess, I don't know, if you go back a ways in Myanmar's history, we had flawed elections in 2010. Everybody thought they were useless. And they ended up actually not being too bad. So I keep cautiously optimistic, not that these elections will change anything, but begin to be a bit of a starting point to move on, because the country has been in this 5-year stint of obviously very severe civil war, economic decline. And so people really are looking, would like to have a new start. Of course, people don't trust the military at all. But maybe this will push the military once they take office, I guess, as the election winners. I don't know. I'm just being somewhat playing the devil's advocate, because everybody says it's a total waste of time. And what I guess I'm trying to argue is, who knows? Maybe this will be a start of something else. It won't happen in 6 months. It won't happen in 3 years. But the beginning of a way out of this mess.
Will the election, though, usher in new people in the lineup, essentially? The overall result is a foregone conclusion. But could we see a shakeup of personnel?
Oh, I think that's somewhat possible. I was at a meeting in Chiang Mai, Thailand, in early December, where there were Chinese, people from Myanmar, and there was some hope that the military would recognize that just keeping Min Aung Hlaing and his ilk at the top was not going to lead anywhere, and that maybe they would give him another job and maybe bring in some other leaders that could maybe start negotiating for something a little bit different. But, you know, we don't know. The military has been so reluctant to give up any power, that it's not a foregone conclusion that this will turn into nirvana, that's for sure.
Murray Hebert, head of research at Bauer Group Asia in Washington. For a change of pace now, Boxing Day delivers a range of traditions in Australia, from the Sydney to Hobart yacht race, to the cricket, to the sales at the shops, and for many, it's the day to head to the cinema. Well, for his guide to the best Boxing Day movies, here's film critic Stephen A. Russell.
You can tell I'm from Scotland, so I'm going to jump back to the old country and recommend one from Triangle of Sadness star Harris Dickinson. Now, people will know him as a movie star, but he has his debut directorial feature in cinemas right now, as of today, Urchin. And Barbara, this is a really fascinating one. He wrote the screenplay as well. He's not the main star, you know, he's taken a back seat. And instead, English actor Frank Delane plays Mike. Now, he is a really mercurial chap in this film. So we meet him where he's kind of down and out. He doesn't have a home. He has struggled with addiction, but he's trying to get back, you know, trying to just work hotel jobs, picking up litter, anything he can do. And you know what? It sounds like a grim story, but it's it really does. And even as I'm saying it, I'm thinking, you have to pull this back, Stephen. But look, he's a really cheeky chappy. There's some fantastical little strange, you know, moods and illusions about what might have happened in his past. But look, I think Frank Delane is a great actor, and he is someone you root for. Should we listen to a little clip, maybe?
Let's do it.
We've set you up at a local hostel. So, tell me about this job.
Yeah, I've got a chef role in a hotel.
Enjoy yourself, it's one of the best hotels in London, so...
Is it?
Yeah, it's on the top list in UK.
All right, the steak, well done with fish!
Was you working before your sentence?
Not really. So I was sleeping on the streets for a while.
Get up!
Hello.
What are you doing?
Sorry, I'll just close my eyes for a second.
Oh dear, it's quite the misadventure. Now, Harris Dickin is known, as you said, for his acting, but what did you make of his directing?
Look, it's really great. I think what you get, Barbara, when you get an actor directing actors is they're obviously going to focus on performance. So, you know, he really gives that incredible intimacy where you really, you know, watch this character Mike and you genuinely are willing him to make the best decisions. He does not always, fair warning, but you know, you're willing him to make it. And also Dickinson does pop up in a support role as his kind of frenemy, where, you know, half the time he's kind of the good angel on his shoulder and the other time he's very much not. So, you know, if you really love Harris Dickinson as well, it's great to see him and Frank Delane bounce off one another in this film.
It certainly sounds interesting, which does appear appropriate. Perhaps we will need a bit of Boxing Day challenge. What else is on your list?
Well, look, I feel like you said you've chosen a dark one, Stephen, and unfortunately, I've also chosen another dark one. But look, I'm sure a lot of your listeners love literary books, so I'm going to go to the gripping documentary Orwell 2+2=5, and this is basically the latest documentary from Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck. Now, he did the brilliant documentary I Am Not Your Negro about the American activist James Baldwin, and this one is very much about Orwell's books. You know, you hear a lot of 1984 and Animal Farm narrated, but also a lot of his own diaries. And the idea being, he was back then writing a warning about populist leaders and dangerous governments. And flash forward, Barbara, here we are. And what did we learn? I don't know. Did we learn much?
Well, I think we've got a little clip of that one as well. Let's have a listen.
When I sit down to write a book, I write it because there is some lie that I want to expose.
Again, how many fingers?
my starting point is always a feeling of injustice. The very concept of objective truth is fading out of this world.
I'm going to set down what I dare not say aloud to anyone.
This prospect frightens me much more than bombs.
What do you think, Stephen? Should we go see it?
Look, I know that death, doom and disaster is a bit of a tough ask at Christmas, but, you know, even listening to the show earlier on, Barbara, and we're, you know, we're hearing about Putin and so on, I think it's really important that we all know our history, that we know these patterns, that we are, you know, alive to the dangers, and we kind of rally for truth and justice and peace. And look, it's got an amazing score by Alex Ayegi as well. And I'm a wee bit biased, Barbara, but there is some beautiful footage of the Scottish island of Jura, where Orwell spent his last years and where he wrote 1984. So look, even if it is a bit heavy going, you've got stunning images to look at as well. So I'd heartily recommend Orwell 2+2=5.
Film critic Stephen A. Russell there. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Barbara Miller and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening this Boxing Day. I'll be back with The Wrap the same time next week.